When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Peoples and Things, where we explore human life with technology. I'm Lee Vinsel. Oh man, these little intros I do. What do you think? Do you like them? I can't really remember why I decided to have introductions, but I think it was about contextualizing how I see the guests I'm having on and their work in a bigger picture. But what is that really? I mean, there are probably several bigger pictures into which we can place any guest or their work. But one big picture that suits them all is the question of how to do technology studies well, which is the heart of the whole Peoples and Things project. You can learn more about that larger mission in our newsletter, which I'll put in the show notes for this episode. Another place you can hear me talk about doing technology studies well, including the methods that are involved in that, is our most recent episode with Bob Charette. But there's another element to these introductions too, which is that I do them because they give me joy. I don't know about you, but sometimes for me, life can feel all wrung out and bone dry, and it's hard to remember the passion, scintillating bliss, and joy of life. But I have so much fun writing these little intros. I mean, some of them, I know for months before I do them what I'm going to say on a specific guest episode. And for those months, I'm just reworking and refining the jokes in my head. Doing the stand-up. And there's so much pleasure in that, thinking through the structure and the wordplay and all the little pieces, the great joy of writing. True joy. And recently I bumped into a podcaster I really respect at a conference, and she said, "I love your intros." And then a kind of cute little giggle came out of her. And I was like, well, there's one. But sometimes I worry that my little intros can distract listeners from an important fact. Almost all of the folks that I have on because I admire them. I think it's clear if you listen to the show, or have read a lot of my writing, that I think a great deal of work done in technology studies really, really sucks. It's empirically and conceptually thin. I mean, stuff like anticipatory governance. The biggest reason I started this podcast is to celebrate good and strong work. My desire to have the guests on that we do arises from a place of deep admiration and esteem. That is very true of someone like today's guest, Asif Siddiqui, a professor of history at Fordham University. I have not had the chance to hang out with Asif nearly as much as I'd like to. It's probably most accurate to say that he and I have mutual friends. But Asif is someone I have always looked up to. He has a wonderful mixture of curiosity, including wide-ranging interests and seriousness. He really does the fucking work. It's probably most accurate to say that Asif began his career as a historian of Soviet technology. And in the interview, we talk about his book, The Red Rocket's Glare, Space Flight and the Russian Imagination, 1857 to 1957, but he's also expanded beyond space history and Soviet history in so many interesting ways, including getting into the history of the technology of music and pop songs. He's also, I think, been an important leader in the Society for the History of Technology for focusing on global history in ways I commend. So I'm going to keep on going with my silly little intros, most of all because they bring me joy. And fuck, my brothers and sisters of the PNT, believe me when I say that I need it. I hope they bring you a little joy too. But I want you to remember that the guests I have on here, they're here because I admire them, which, as big pictures go, may be the most essential of all. That's certainly true of historian Asif Siddiqui. That dude fucking rules. Hey, get excited! Asif, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Wow, exciting.
I want to waltz through your career a bit today to give folks a sense of what you're about, but maybe we could start with the Red Rockets, Claire. If you were to tell a stranger about that book, what would you say it's about, and what were you trying to do with it now, something like 14 years ago when it came out?
Yeah, that's always the, you know, the elevator pitch, but I think in very simple relatively simple terms, I wanted to reframe the story of the Soviet effort to explore space by looking at activity on the ground from the bottom up, so to speak. And so we think of authoritarian states as having, you know, sort of very large scale science programs. But even in those states, there's activity on the ground. People have agency. People are doing stuff that makes a difference. So I wanted to tell that story and perhaps offer some thoughts on the fact of the importance of culture in the practice of engineering. So to put it in a fancy way, I wanted to say that engineering and imagination happen together. They don't happen in sequence. And so one of the things I sort of came out of the book was that in the case of the Soviet space program, they were dreaming, they were writing, they were doing science fiction, but it wasn't like that led to the engineering. It happened simultaneously, and there was a give and take and back and forth between the two. And that's really the story of that book, really.
Yeah, man. It's cool. And so you got a PhD in history at Carnegie Mellon, but you started life as an engineer and then got an MBA and stuff? I mean, how'd you kind of get into this business?
Yeah, I had a long and circuitous path to where I am today. Some of it doesn't really make sense. I did start off as an engineer. I think I had this, I harbored some ambition to, I was really good at math and I was, you know, I did well and all the other stuff. And so there was a moment where I thought I would be an engineer. But once I had the opportunity to do some engineering work, I realized that I didn't really like it that much, the actual work of it. And later on, of course, you come to realize that maybe I like to study engineers more than I like to be one. So I think after that, I sort of decided, there was a moment where I decided maybe I'll just go into the corporate world because I had an engineering degree. And I did do an MBA, but even that was sort of maybe, not the best idea. I kept being drawn back to this idea that I liked to study engineering, and I didn't have the words or the concepts to even think about those things. And so at some point, I got in touch with, you know, some professors in academia, and they kind of put the words on what I was thinking, which was the history of technology or something like that. And David Hounshill, who was my advisor, and I'm sure you know him quite well, was one of the first persons I spoke to who gave shape to what I was thinking, that this, it looks like this is what you're interested in. So that led me on a path to a more rigorous academic sort of education.
Yeah. And I mean, so I came out of Carnegie Mellon too. Hounshill was my advisor as well. And so, I mean, like, you know, what was Carnegie Mellon like for you, and who'd you work with there?
Well, yeah, that was also formative. And in order to understand the Red Rocket Sky, the book that I wrote, it's really that really the heart of it goes back, because at the time, David Hounshell was an eminent historian of technology, was running had an NSF grant for to fund graduate education for Cold War science. And we there was a cohort of us, about, I don't know, 6 to 8 students. And so he brought me over to Carnegie Mellon, but I was sort of swimming around of what to write about. And then I met another faculty member, Wendy Goldman, who is a Russianist, a Soviet historian. And she really kind of rejigged my head in some sense to think about social history and history from below. And so I was trying to put those two things together. How do you write? And I was very interested in Russian history. How do you write a social history, or especially a history of science, from the ground up? And that's something that I think I was trying to, I struggled through in graduate school and ended up with a dissertation, but that was really important for me to redirect the story from elites. And so that's really how I ended up. That's why Carnegie Mellon was a very important, sort of gestational period for my thinking. And there were other faculty members, many of whom I'm sure you know, who were important in shaping that. And the other thing I would say at CMU was that the diversity of the faculty members and the students too was really important to me in terms of intellectual diversity. Being exposed to people who are doing very, very different things, but who you could still learn from. And then I think that instilled in me a little bit of a curiosity.
Yeah, man. I hear you. I feel like, were you one of these like annoying people who like published like a book or two during grad school? Didn't you have these books before?
I did. I had a career as it's weird. The bottom line is I love to write. And so and of course even as a teenager, it's terrible writing, but just the practice of it, I'd like to write. And so, but it is true, before I got into graduate school, I had a sort of sideline. I was, the 1990s, the collapse of the Soviet Union had revealed an enormous amount, like an alternate story of their own history, including the space program. And I was beginning to get sort of exposed to it and just fascinated by it. And I reached out to NASA. There was a gentleman there, Roger Lanius, who was the chief historian. And this was before graduate school. And he liked some of my writing, and he said, "Do you want to write a book?" I said, "Sure." And I had no idea how to write a book, but he helped me quite a bit. And I did write a book. It took me 5 years, just as I was getting into graduate school. That book did come out when I was in my second year or something. I can't remember now. It was a kind of a crazy thing, because I couldn't believe it myself that the book came out while I was in graduate school. And here I was working on my dissertation, which was a much more rigorous historical sort of training. I did have that sort of pre-academic career, if you will.
I think you kind of explained it. I was going to ask you about kind of like how social history, because you talk about social history, which you were just described as kind of history from the bottom up, kind of got into Rocket Red's Glare. And it made sense that you're saying you worked with Wendy Goldman. That's one aspect of Red Rocket's Glare. I feel like that's one aspect I've always liked of the book, the social history aspect. And I also feel like, in the history of technology, there are these glances back where social history and history of technology could have come together and did, briefly. Yeah. There's like Ruth Cowan has, the book, but it's like,
of course,
I feel like we need more of it in a sense. I don't know. I just feel like that kind of social historical approach to, the making of technologies, the production of technologies, and also consumption of technologies.
Absolutely.
I don't know, it drops out sometimes,
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm at one with you. This is a larger conversation about the place of social history in the historical profession, which has been de-emphasized in favor of all sorts of other things, and sometimes not so interesting to me. But I think, I am very much of that school that I'm interested in the everyday lives of technology. And I think, it's not that I necessarily disavow or think that there's no place for these kinds of top-down, large-scale technological systems and what, you know, that kind of stuff. It's just that I think there's more to it. And of course, in the 1980s, you had, you know, all the stuff on Users and stuff, Trevor Pinch and those guys. And of course, your stuff with Maintenance. I think these are ways to rethink those issues of social history and technology. But I think very much these days, if, and I could be wrong, anecdotally, it seems to me people who are doing STS, less history of technology, but STS are interested in different questions than everyday lives. You know, those kinds of things are not so much at the forefront of what graduate students are doing. There's obviously a lot of cultural stuff going on, but also, I don't know, it's not the necessarily the sort of more ground up type of histories that we.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, that's also a reaction to the kind of Whiggish histories of technology that we did have in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So because that was all great man history. I mean, we all know that narrative. And then so there was a pushback against that, and that push. I happened to go to graduate school at the tail end of that when that was still a thing. Mm-hmm. And I think by the time I got out, maybe by, I think roughly the first decade of this century, I think social history of technology as a thing, I don't know if it's a thing anymore.
We need to bring it back, I think.
We need to bring it back.
Another really interesting part in your book, and you draw this out, I mean, you explore this topic in a series of articles too, but there's this tension between like the secrecy of the Soviet space program versus kind of like this popular imagination.
Right,
and part of it's, I mean, we'll talk in a bit about the kind of longer history of sci-fi and all these kind of, know, interests, but just this secrecy versus like the popular is an interesting topic.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always been also very much of interest to me, the way in which, you know, to put it in sort of fanciful terms, the regulation of knowledge and secrecy. Again, my interest in, what shall we say, authoritarian societies, I'm deeply interested in how knowledge can be regulated and channeled in all sorts of directions.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think that's what makes the Soviet case and probably some other cases so interesting. And space is an interesting topic because space exploration depends on a kind of populist engagement. Oh, it's cool and it's awesome and we're going to go out and, you know, we live on Mars. That kind of populist engagement depends to a large degree on imagery and writing and all sorts of things that have to be sort of fostered. But yet so much of it, of course, space has one huge foot in the military world in every country, which is largely a national security kind of thing, and you have to sort of control information. That tension runs through a lot of what I write about, and I'm interested in the you know, give and take between secrecy and openness within space. And I think that probably runs through many Cold War science. I'm not saying anything original, but Cold War science is really just rampant with that tension. But it's more extreme in cases like the Soviet Union. But I'm sure it happens here and you know, other countries too. So I think that's also very much running through. So I've been doing a lot of writing on secrecy recently. And I just, a couple of years ago published a lengthy piece of the AHR actually.
Yeah.
On Soviet secrecy, which is about trying to theorize how secrecy works when scientists are involved, especially in an authoritarian state, and how the control of information is channeled in all sorts of different ways. So it's a longstanding interest of mine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, when you write this book that ends with Sputnik in a sense, right?
Yeah.
But it goes back to 1857, so a century before. I mean, so what led you to do that? I mean, what was the thought there? You're like, I'm going to go back 100 years. Yeah.
Well, part of the reason. I mean, this is part of the maybe a dissertation mindset, which is that one of the hallmarks of doing history, at least in graduate school, is that your advisors push you to look further and further back for the roots of whatever you're studying. And of course, the story, I just, you know, when I started there, I was gonna, I think I had some idea that I wanted to revisit Sputnik and think about how this came about, because that story was still very blurry, like we didn't really understand much about it. And then I discovered all this stuff on the, you know, enthusiasm on the ground and amateurs building rockets in the 1930s, who were really crucial to making Sputnik happen in the 50s. And so once I started looking at the amateurs in the 1930s, I started to realize that their inspiration came from people in the 19th century. And so I had to go back even further to disentangle that. And their inspiration was often science fiction, Jules Verne, mm-hmm. and all this other stuff. So I wanted to then, I didn't want that to be a separate story or a little piece in the introduction. I wanted that part to be fundamental to their worldview. And so that's why the story went back to 1857 is actually the birth year of one of these founding sort of theorists of the Soviet space program. And so that was a perfect century before that. And so, yeah, I started to follow a lot of this weird. Russia is very strange in that, or perhaps not strange, but interesting in that people were really thinking about space already by about 1900. Like, this was already a kind of a semi-mass phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it peaks and explodes in the 1920s. And so I think one of the interesting things to me was, why was this even happening there? Of all the weird things to sort of promote and think and write about, why was space a thing? And so that was the other question I had. There, you know, there's other things that were in the public domain, but this became kind of a weird barometer of Russian interest in sort of the exotic and those kinds of things.
Yeah. I feel like this... the tradition of Russian cosmism, I'm going to have you tell us what this is about in a second, but I feel like it got really hot there for like right around, like right after when your book came out. Like, I remember Steve Fuller, the STS guy, who is himself a kind of mystic of sorts, got really into it. And like the transhumanists got really into it.
Right.
So, I mean, exactly. I mean, can you first like tell listeners what cosmism is? And then I also want to hear your kind of historically informed take on like the role think it plays, you know?
Yeah, it's actually, but you're right. Starting from the sort of the last thing you said, there is a contemporary interest in cosmism, especially among Silicon Valley people or Silicon Valley adjacent people. And I can get to that in a second. But I think, that stuff emerges in the late 19th century. There's one figure associated with Nikolai Fyodorov, but there's actually many other sort of satellite figures. But the basic idea, at least as articulated at the time, was that, when we die, it's a very quasi-mystical and occultish sort of tradition.
Yeah.
That when we die, our particles get spread out into outer space, and that in order to reconstitute or to be mortal, really, and not to die, we can reconstitute these particles into new living beings who will live forever in outer space and so forth. And that's the very simplistic version of it. But the idea is that we can somehow continue to live beyond ourselves in some other form in outer space. And Fyodorov doesn't have the language necessarily to talk about these things like we do, but the basic ideas are there. So this thing gets kind of attached to a more, like a more technological kind of futurism in the early 20th century, which is really like the sort of H.G. Wells and Jules Verne version of technology, which is that, we're going to have, flying cars and submarines and all sorts of other things. So the idea is that the kind of more second industrial revolution version of the future gets meshed with the more occultish sort of weird spiritual stuff of cosmism. And that has a kind of flowering in the 1920s in the Soviet Union. But once the Stalinist state begins to sort of assert itself, that stuff goes away for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But it is worth pointing out that a lot is made that, there are lots and lots and lots of people following this stuff. It's not true even in the 1920s. There's a small amount of people who are very interested in this, but not a lot of people. And that's what I've tried to reassert in some of my recent writings, that I actually wrote a piece called The Invention of Cosmism, which is that at the time, historically, it's a very fringe phenomenon. But more recently, in the last 10, 20 years, people have kind of almost like reimagined the past, saying that, this was all over the place. It's not true. I've looked at this history very in great detail. And the other character is Tsiolkovsky, who is the sort of founding father of the Soviet space program, who wrote a lot of the mathematical equations. And there's this whole story that he was tutored by this Fyodorov character, this mystic, but that's also not true. There's all sorts of historical falsehoods. Either way, this kind of mystic idea is now very much, I think, post-Soviet. It comes back with a vengeance, and of course, yeah. A lot of people in the West pick it up because yeah. It really taps into this kind of, we're gonna. It provides a kind of justification, for all the East transhumanists and people. And there's also a deeply kind of what I call unsettling aspect of it. One is that it's very sort of, it taps into the libertarian kind of, I'm going to go out there and I don't, because one of the elements of the original cosmos narrative is that nature must be conquered and we must be brought to heel. Nature is an enemy. And so this thing is very much part of it. Like, we can rejig the Earth itself, we can terraform Mars, all this stuff is very much in line with cosmism. The other unsettling mm-hmm. part, which people don't talk about, is when the original ideas did emerge in the late 19th, early 20th century, they were, not to put it, I can't put it any other way, they were really racist. I mean, they were really thinking about eugenics. Like, this was there's a kind of weird, only white people can go kind of articulation of cosmism, which there are actual quotes which I won't repeat, but basically saying people of color are not invited, and if anything they should be destroyed. And it's very unsettling to read this stuff in the 1920s. And so people kind of, I don't know what to make of all that for the contemporary audience, but I think given the kind of tech bro fascination with a space, I think there's a case to be made that there's a kind of resurgence of, I don't want to call it fascism, but it's definitely bordering on some sort of unsettling worldview of the future. And so I think there is a lineage.
I mean, I think so many discussions of transhumanism, racism and eugenics end up coming up at some point, right?
Even in the contemporary world. Eugenics is very much central. And yeah, a lot of these transhumanists are very much, they might not use the word, but eugenics is on their mind,
And so, another question is, a historical question is, how easy, you have this story that begins before the Soviet Revolution, and so how easy for it was this, were there tensions there? Was it easier for the Soviets to kind of just, obviously the mysticism had to go, you've already said that, but was it easy for them to kind of just adopt this excitement for space? Was that frictionless, or were there a lot of tensions there?
That's a good question. I, because the one obvious comparison is the United States, and the United States didn't have this kind of space craze that the Soviet Union had, at least not in the 1920s. There was one in Germany. And so Germany and the Soviet Russia are the only two places we see this madness, a kind of an explosion. Movies are made, there's art exhibitions, books are written, people are building models, there's museum exhibitions. It's kind of insane what's going on in the 20s about space. And it's very similar in Germany. The people who are kids, basically, when I say kids, early adolescents in the 20s, are the ones who were in charge of the Soviet space program in the 50s and 60s, in the Cold War. So I try to sort of make that connection that these people grew up with this stuff. It wasn't So one of the arguments I make in the book, when Sputnik happened, the nation was kind of, or a large part of the population, was already well marinated in space. To them, this was going to happen. To the rest of the world, it was a Sputnik shock. Oh my God, the Russians, they have with their collective farms and tractors and potatoes have suddenly launched a satellite into orbit. But for the average Russian Ivan, it was like, yeah, this is what was going to happen anyway. And they weren't
it's what we were doing, man.
So that's one of the arguments. I think it was startling to me to discover that. The more I dug deeper, I was in whenever, I'd go to Moscow for archival research. I'd be in the Lenin Library, and I was amazed by the thousands and thousands of books on space published before 1957, before Sputnik.
Yeah.
Like rows and rows and rows. And so it was, it that I remember I that visual just kind of just completely bowled me over. I was like, well, there's something going on here, and I could maybe write about it. And I think, I'll just add one more thing, that it fed into the you know, after World War II, the Soviet Union was devastated. And, you know, I think space allowed them, no pun intended, a space to imagine a better future. Because life is really terrible after World War II. People don't have housing, cities are destroyed. And slowly, as the country reconstitutes itself, it allows people to imagine a better future. So I think there's something about space itself that allows people a safety or something to think that without any of the practical considerations, we could just make the leap into a better life. You don't have to worry. Mm-hmm. If that imagination is really important in allowing people some kind of excitement. I think so. And the tension, if there is that the entire state, once it becomes mobilized for the space program in the 60s at the height of the Cold War, that, you know, again, because it's a kind of a military secret enterprise, that tension becomes very, very much part of the Soviet enterprise. So I think, and the U.S., of course, provides a perfect enemy at the time. And, you know, NASA is going to the moon. And so that sort of thing becomes a kind of competitive mode, you know, which is the sort of bipolar space race thing. But I think, the popular enthusiasm for it never really abates until the 70s. And that's, we see a steep decline, not just in the Soviet Union, but the United States too. And for all sorts of reasons. There's a steep decline. And the US case is interesting because it, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, the Vietnam War was crucial in this, but, you know, people are like, why are we spending money on this? And so that becomes a kind of a crucial, you know, kind of measure of people's just general disgruntlement about space. Like, why are we doing this stuff? But in the 60s, I think it was different. Although polls show that even in the 60s, there was never unanimous support for the space program in this country. People, I mean, the 60s was a very, very not a good time for this country in so many ways, including issues like inequality, racial relations, the Vietnam War. And I think people forget that. They look at Apollo and they look at it with rose-colored eyes, but even then people were not entirely on board with the whole thing. And it's very much the case in the Soviet Union. So,
Yeah, one of the things, I mean, just going back a second to this kind of like, it was common sense for Russians that this was going to happen. Yeah. I love your kind of like last chapter, which is on Sputnik and the program. Yeah. And you really focus on workers there, which I love, of course. Yeah. And like, you're like, for them, it was just like work. They were like, they didn't see this as like some special thing. And it was only like later, like with nostalgia and stuff, that it got built up into this big thing. But for them, it was just like what they were doing, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It was just a day's work. And I try to get into the sort of granular, you know, lives at the factory and so forth. They're just going about their business. And, and the guy at the top, Korolev, he's like, you guys, do you know what you've done? You know, and the guy's like, well, I just, you know, I just went and built this thing, just like, you know. And so I think, it's a very amazing moment. And the other thing, it's very hard to remember, again, going back to the Soviet kind of victory after World War II, but the country is destroyed, is that Sputnik is an amazing moment in post-war Soviet history, because for the first time they did something that the world cared about. And so I think people were just so the average worker, and which I try to get into in some other articles, is that they for them this was a moment of pride. Genuine pride, like we built this in our factories. I also tried to look at their belief in socialism as not a cynical thing, which was a difficult thing to do. And there's lots of debates among Soviet historians whether, you know, people bought into communism as a cynical, upwardly mobile kind of strategy, or did they genuinely believe in it? But I just try to take it at face value. You know, people were, at least at the very bottom worker level, like they were invested in what they considered to be socialism and workers' rights and those kinds of things. And I just found it, I try to be less cynical about that. I try to take them at face value. And that was an interesting sort of peek into that world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then, I mean, are you working on a book on the Gulag? Is that like the thing you turn to next?
Yes. Yeah.
And like, what led you to do that?
Well, one of the things writing Red Rocket's Glare, I noticed, and other people have known this, is one of the leading engineers in the Soviet space program, actually many of them, were prisoners in the Gulag. And so I was always fascinated with that little part of their lives before they came out and ran the space program. So I, for the longest time, I just put that in my head, like, I need to pursue that story a little bit more. And then as I got into it, even while I was writing my dissertation, really, I started to realize that there is a whole world within this camp system, this forced labor camp system of scientists and engineers and experts who were somehow attached to it. And so that became a kind of book project, which I'm finishing now, which is basically, it's become something very different now.
Mm-hmm.
But the book is basically, again, in a nutshell, it's a book about the experts who designed and built the forced labor camp system. Most histories of the Gulag, as one should expect, we're told, you know, about the victims and the prisoners and so forth. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago and so forth. But I was really interested as a historian of technology, like how was this thing made and designed?
Yeah.
So I started to, it took, and that's why this project has been going for 10 years and it's taken me so long. It was a very deeply complicated project. I had to go into lots of archives to find people who, for example, planned the location. They had geologists figure out where, you know. So that's a chapter about how geology becomes a kind of handmaiden of this.
Yeah.
There's a chapter on just the urban planning of architects about who designed the camps. And there's other chapters that get into how the Soviet state also saw the Gulag, to use a Hughesian term, as a technological system. They saw that that they could use this as, so the Gulag was a forced labor, you know, they built roads and other things for the Soviet government, but they also produced enormous knowledge and expertise that was channeled back into the state. Things like, first of all, the Soviet Union sort of, or nowadays Russia, sort of knowledge about the Russian landmass comes from the Gulag, because geologists, earth sciences specialists, botanists, all sorts of people were working within the Gulag to kind of ascertain the Soviet landmass. There's also medical knowledge that comes from the Gulag and how to live in very cold climates.
Huh.
Our knowledge of permafrost, which is now melting because of climate change, comes from Russian scientists who were in the Gulag. So that, all of that is part of the story about how you cannot tell the history of, I guess, Soviet science in the 20th century without the Gulag. And so it gets into a lot of thorny questions about science and coercion and incarceration, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, I try to make some commentary at the end about general the carceral state in any country, which is that eventually it comes to this mode of, it becomes something else. You know, that's what the Gulag.
Yeah.
So that's what the book is about.
That's cool, man. I didn't know you were up to this until, I don't know, recently, a year ago or something. Yeah. And it's great, because I've been saying for, I don't know, years now, it's maintainer stuff led me to think about it, but it's like the prisons as technological systems, I think we just don't have enough work on this yet. And so when I learned about the approach you're taking, I think it's great, man. I can't wait to check it out.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. There's actually almost no work about it. I mean, as we all know, there's all sorts of limitations about the Hughesian socio-technical systems, but I still find it useful, extremely. And especially when you teach it, you start to realize there's all sorts of good things about it. And I do think that yeah, that aspect is very crucial to this book. I do hope that when the book comes out, it's seen and perhaps read by people who are interested in other carceral apparatuses
exactly.
elsewhere. Because I think there's something there about the way in which, I mean, and this came to me actually because I was back in the day when, this maybe 15 years ago, I heard about prisoners being used by Sprint, which, you know, the telecommunications company here in the U.S., to do all sorts of work. And I was like, I can't remember the story anymore right now, but this was around 2005. And Sprint was using incarcerated prisoners in Texas to do basically collect data about some their consumer base. And I thought that was crazy because it seemed to be like, this is the corporation, this is private-public partnerships. And of course, nowadays with the privatization of prisons, it's happening much more. But I was interested in that there's knowledge being produced. It's not like these prisoners are out there doing something, you know, so that was got me interested as a kind of historian of technology. What is it that they're producing?
Yeah.
And can we think of these systems? And the Soviet case is a kind of almost like a ground zero for it because they really institutionalized it. They and yet the histories of the Gulag are never talk about this. The scientists
right,
and
right,
engineers.
Right.
So they and so this is a kind of I thought to I think it'll be a useful corrective to that story to bring
yeah.
in scientists and engineers.
I would not be surprised.
Well. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't be surprised if there was not like global international knowledge flows of this around this stuff too, right? I mean, that
yes.
would be a cool
oh, wow.
project,
yeah.
like larger, you know, more multiple person
yeah.
project to think about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's
knowledge
an excellent,
moving
around
that.
Suggestion.
Yeah.
yeah, and I bet you there is. There's got to be, yeah, and that's a,
yeah.
that's an excellent suggestion, and I think, and it probably didn't start recently. I mean, I do
yeah,
think there's.
Exactly.
The privatization of prisons in the U.S. I don't have the data in my head anymore, but seems to suggest that it's incarceration is, you know, the way we think of incarceration, obviously, is the nature of it is changing in the U.S., but probably globally, too. You know, and
yeah.
so think about Blackwater and all sorts of other black sites. And, you know, I think... there's
yeah.
definitely a global network of things going on. And
yeah.
I would guess that a lot of it, you know, a lot of experts, you know, defined very loosely are involved in it. One
yeah.
of the arguments I make in the Gulag book is that many of these experts came outside of, from, let's say, the Academy of Sciences, who came into the camps to study or do work with the prisoners, not in a kind of, and I don't necessarily make or want to get into sort of Nazi comparison. They weren't experimenting on the prisoners. They were working with the prisoners. So they would
right.
have teams. So, but often there's often teams within the prisoners who are, you know, experts. So they're tapping into the prisoner population because they know they have degrees in engineering. So they go, well, we'll form a team over here. They're going to build us a better, something like, for example, weather systems. They did a lot of research on meteorology up in the Arctic at Gulag camp. So they had good scientists who were all imprisoned in the Gulag. So they have these teams working on. So some of the best weather science came out in the 1930s and 40s from Soviet prisoners in the Gulag.
That's wild. Wild.
yeah. So, and I'll just mention one other thing. Kate Brown, who's a professor at MIT, I think, who wrote Plutopia, the book on.
Yeah.
Comparing the two nuclear cities. She wrote a fabulous article a few years ago in the journal Critica, which looked at Guantanamo Bay as a kind of, a weird little hub of activity. And she talked about, you know, all the sort of psychiatric people who would go down there and do all sorts of weird
yeah.
experiments and things like that. So I think that's also was in my head about that too, the way in which experts are mobilized often in places, incarcerated spaces. So yeah,
that's great, man. I love it. You know, one thing I love about your work, Asif, is just like you're a curious guy and you look around and you dig into all kinds of things. And I think the book that best exemplifies your range is One Track Mind, Capitalism, Technology, and the Art of the Pop Song, which is an edited volume you pulled together.
Right.
And yeah. Especially when it came out, I was even more envious that I hadn't been had the time to put something into it. But not only did you pull this cool volume together, but you also wrote an essay in it on MIA's Paper Planes song. So right. Tell folks a bit about this project. And, you know, one of the things I want to talk to you about here is kind of like music technology and and this kind of like approach to thinking about these things.
Well, you know, I mean, you and I have talked about this before. We're both very much into music. We listen to a lot of music.
Yeah.
We both are, you know, curious, I suppose. And so music is definitely a part of my worldview. I probably, you know, going into graduate school, I remember thinking, should I just start, go into music? Because I was a guitarist for a band, and I thought for a second that maybe I'd have more luck that way. I didn't. I put this thing together. Partly the reason was I met a writer named Simon Reynolds, who has written a lot of books on music. He's English, and he lives in Southern California. And I had a fellowship at Caltech 1 year. And so I kind of hung out with him. And we had this idea that we were going to... there were songs that we liked that... we wanted to take a deep dive on, like an essay. And so we started to put together an idea to bring a whole bunch of people together to write on one song. And my colleague, Nicholas Paul, who had the idea that, why don't you call it One Track Mind, which was a brilliant title. but I'm also interested in technology, obviously, you know, and so I've always been interested in all sorts of technical aspects of music history, from performance like electrification to recording to playing and to distribution, how do you get music? And so all these things are fascinating to me. So I thought that would be an interesting way to talk about to help organize this book of essays, and of course capitalism, because it's everywhere. And so so in the end we had 16 writers, many of them not academics, like Simon, who are just journalists, critics, and some of them, many of them were musicologists, not all of them were historians or even historians of technology. And we had a couple of workshops and to work through our essays to see the common themes. And it was a lot of fun. And I, as a historian of technology, I think I was really pleased with the way in which we did bring in technology to all, a lot of this.
Yeah.
My own essay was very much about technology. It was the best song by MIA called Paper Planes, as you said, which was a big hit about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago.
So
I got interested in digital sampling and,
we have this late, shared background in Nine Inch Nails and this kind of like electro music.
Yes, exactly.
I thought MIA was a perfect extension of this conversation.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And in fact, a lot of the Nine Inch Nails stuff was on my mind as I was writing the essay, because I was really interested in how, you know, like once you start moving away from guitars into computers and sequencers and this kind of, or samplers, how to think about virtuosity. You know, you always think about a violinist or a guitarist or a pianist, but how, what is a virtue, somebody who's, sort of extremely skilled at playing a sampler? Yeah. How do you even, and not, and that's just a, and it's also a performative thing. Like, you know, I remember going to see one of these, I think it might have been Kraftwerk or something, and they just pressed a button and stood back and let the thing play. And I thought that
Well, Trent Reznor would throw keyboards around just to have something to do on stage, you know, because it was mostly just playing behind him. Yeah.
That's right. I remember these videos from the 90s where he would like smash keyboards and stuff.
Yeah.
So I always thought about like virtuosity has to be redefined as something else. So it becomes, I think it's become more about like kind of computer hacking skills. Like that's your skill now. Like, so a good, these, you know, massive pop producers who work with Taylor Swift or whoever, They're not brilliant guitarists or pianists. They're just, they're really good at other things. They, you know, they know how to program things. They know how to put things together. So that's what I was interested with the MIA. One of the things I wanted to get at was, because the studio and technology is essentially a male gender domain, MIA never gets the credit. So whenever people were talking about her track, they would always want to know about the guy producer behind her, like whose name was Diplo. So she got
in interviews very combative.
Like, look, I did all this. The producer guy was just, put this song together. They would always go, well, what did he do? You know? So I think that's because we gender all this stuff very much male. Like it's just a domain in the studio where the female singer sings the song and the guy comes in and does all that stuff. So my article was trying to get at those questions in some way. But the other essays, I think, were just great. I was really happy. And I do remember reaching out to you to contribute. I know you were super busy, but.
Yeah, me and Patrick, I think McRae were a part of a conversation.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think what you just said about gender, though, is really fascinating. I just, one of your Fordham colleagues, Susan Schmidt-Horning, who is just a wonderful person, she has an essay in it. And she was, for folks who don't know, she was in a kind of neat rock band in like the early 70s or late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And she just gave a paper at the Society for the History of Technology in L.A., and it was all about how electric guitars and fuzz boxes and stuff were highly gendered male. And if you see women in these guitar magazines in the 60s and such, it's always a girl with an acoustic guitar. So it's just fascinating kind of to draw it out a bit more, how like the tech side of music becomes so gendered male in the way you're describing. And I bet that goes back. Yeah.
And I think to make a contemporary reference, I think that's part of maybe the resistance to many people to Taylor Swift's own positionality in all of this. No matter what you think of her songwriting or her songs, she's obviously clearly in charge of what's going on in the recording studio. But I think a lot of people will go, it's not her, she gets the best producers and whatnot. But I think the resistance that comes from this kind of old school, you know, notion of how it's gendered differently. So yeah, I think there's a lot there to unpack. And Susan's doing really fantastic work. Yeah.
So the other thing you've been up to is, man, you have written about space programs in so many different places on the planet at this point. And you have this wonderful essay that my colleague Fabian Prieto Nanez pointed me to called Who's India? Site in the Origins of the Satellite Television in India. But you're also potentially working on this project on kind of like global space infrastructures. So draw that out. I mean, how have you been kind of thinking about that as a researcher, as you kind of look out at the world and, you know, find all these interesting places?
Well, I mean, it's part of it has to do with often I'm very fortunate that I get invited to give talks. And I was about 10 years ago, I was invited to give a talk at in Santiago, Chile. At the Catholic University of Santiago. And I went down there and my host, Pedro Alonso, he sort of drove me up outside into the mountains outside of the city and showed me a big tracking station that NASA had, which I wasn't aware of at the time. And I was really just stunned by the size and scale of all of this and the fact that there were lots of farming communities beyond it. And apparently whose lives had been, you know, somewhat affected and not always in the best way because of the positioning of this. And then we went and drove to a former Soviet station, which was not too far away from there in the Cold War days, which had been abandoned. So that got me thinking about, well, there's a lot of this stuff in Chile, it must be elsewhere. So I started to discover that an enormous amount of infrastructure was built, mostly in the 60s and 70s, in the post-colonial world. They had to be, these kinds of antennas, tracking stations, sometimes launch sites, had to be built close to the equator because of certain requirements of satellites and so forth. And so they're all in places like India and South Latin America, Africa, huge amount of stuff.
Yeah.
So I started to work on this project to think about what is this, what is all this stuff? And basically, it's a kind of what I call it a history of space on Earth. Like what we have a lot of histories about what happened out there. What did it do to our Earth? And so I'm trying to. It's really a history of three things. It's a history of obviously the space age, but looking at stuff on the Earth. It's a history of infrastructure, Cold War stuff. But it's also a history of how the post-colonial world in many countries sought to assert themselves in relationship with the first world by sometimes negotiating the positioning of infrastructure in places like that, which they thought would be to their benefit. But it turned out, for the most part, these infrastructure caused enormous environmental and social problems, which are huge and sometimes hidden. So the book is a kind of way to recover some of that story. And I'll say one more thing. The book is an attempt, maybe not, I don't know how it'll come out, and to write a global history. You know, we talk about this thing that exists now. We try to teach it, but how do you even write this thing?
Yeah, exactly. It's a real challenge.
It's a real challenge because I wanted to really write one instead of, you know, sort of tokenizing everything. So I don't want to write a giant book. It's just a more of a short 6-7 chapters and then try to theorize like, hey, maybe this is one way to talk about a global history. So that's the other thing I'm doing. Yeah. And yeah, there's a chapter on India and other places too. Yeah.
That's cool, dude. I mean, I think the most exciting thing going on right now in STS and in the Society for the History of Technology is, in SHOT, it gets called like internationalization, right? But I think we just know we need more histories of the Global South and poor nations, and that's happening. And we're meeting in Chile this summer, and you're very much a part of it. You're running a committee that's kind of dealing with these issues. But I see this kind of like, you know, this book project as being very tied up in these larger trends in the field in a good way, in the right way. Yeah. So,
I hope so. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that, and SHOT especially, I think, and you know, other, the HSS too, if you will, but I think has been trying to do this, but it's not easy to do this.
It's not easy, man. And it's very resource intensive, too.
Exactly.
It's expensive.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not just the thinking of it, how to do it. It's also the resources, absolutely. Yeah. And as you know, these societies have very little resources, or they're spread very thin. So it limits what we could do. Often people will say, well, this is, you know, it's the society is stuck in a rut. It's still doing this old school history or whatever. But I think a lot of it is resources. I am pleased with a lot of what SHOT has been doing the last few years.
Me too.
I'm sure it can do more. I think, these are also, as you know, universities at the administrative level find these, you know, catchphrases and go with it without really thinking through, you know, innovation and those kinds of things which you've written about.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think... but the globalization hub of whatever you want to call it has also been, I know at Fordham, it's sort of clumsily stumbling through some initiatives to do this, both in our teaching. What I wanted to do was, and some other, you know, there are some other examples of global histories, but especially like regional stuff, like there's been some good stuff on, like, say, the Indian Ocean world and stuff. But very much lacking in the history of technology. I don't see any, and you may know more, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head that I would say, oh, this is a book to think about globalization or global movements of technology or something. There are good books we have in our discipline that are about other places in the Global South, you know, Eden Medina's book and so forth, that which are notable. But they exist in sort of isolation. It's almost like they don't necessarily. So I think that is a problem that I'm trying to overcome, I suppose.
Yeah, man, I'm with you. I mean, I'm really excited about this, the kind of conversations and initiatives that might come out of this meeting this summer in Chile. And
definitely. I hope,
One way to do it is start to have hubs, I think, in other places. Or yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some good ideas, Gabriel Hecht, has been floating around. And I know that you have some ideas, too. So hubs is a good thing with a world that obviously is so large and big. But it was nice to see in Los Angeles that we had lots of people from Africa and and some other parts of the world, too. So that was great. And that's actually part of this book, is also to write this history by listening to and using voices from the Global South, because I didn't necessarily want to tell a story of infrastructure about, from the records of the State Department. That's another challenge to writing a global history requires sensitivity to local contexts, right?
I have totally.
A chapter on Kenya, for example, and it, as a historian of technology, because we are historians of technology, but we also have a geographical location. One is an Americanist or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think that if you start to do global histories of technology, the thematic allows us a little bit of a entry into other places. Still, I there is a level of insecurity. Like, I'm sure there are historians of Kenya who would be like, this is no good, you have to sort of work through that in some ways, that I'm not coming here as a historian of Kenya, I'm coming here as a historian of technology, right? That's what my insight is.
I mean, I've learned this from Phil Scranton, who's been writing, using fascinating records to write about all these other places on the planet. And I think I think we just can't use that as an excuse. We have to honor the local scholars and learn what we can. But if we use it, if we use this kind of issues as an excuse not to do the work, then we never do the work and we never start the right conversations to globalize the history.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely. Yeah. Exactly. I think people use that as an excuse. But, sometimes you need to jump off the cliff and do the
exactly. Well, Asif, man, I love all the projects you're up to, man. Right. And, as they come out, as they leak out slowly, I will eagerly await them. And we can have another conversation when the next book drops.
All right.
Do you have any sense what the next thing is?
Well, the next book, the Gulag book, hopefully will come out sometime early next year.
Sweet.
And then this other infrastructure book, a bit maybe a year or two down the road. I'm just sort of working, doing stuff, little things here and there. Always, learning from my colleagues like you and Patrick and whoever. So looking forward to SHOT and whatnot.
Well, thanks so much for coming on to talk to me today, buddy.
Thank you, Lee. Have a good day.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of our podcast. You can reach us with questions, comments, and suggestions at leevinsel@gmail.com or by following me on Twitter at STS_news or on YouTube at People's Things. Our podcast is distributed by the New Books Network, the leading platform for academic podcasts, so that you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Peoples and Things, like most things in this world, depends on the work of many people. I want to thank my brother Jake Vinsel for writing the music for the show. I want to thank my buddy Juliana Castro for designing the logos for the podcast. You can check out her work at julianacastro.co. Joe Fort is the producer for the podcast, and Mandy Lamb is the production assistant. This podcast and other Peoples and Things programming are produced in affiliation with Virginia Tech Publishing and supported by the Center for Humanities and the University Libraries at Virginia Tech. For information about other podcasts from Virginia Tech Publishing, visit publishing.vt.edu. For the entire Peoples and Things team, I am Lee Vinsel. And most importantly, I want to thank you for listening. Thanks. Mm-hmm.